20th century, the old rule of warriors don't cry was still in place, personified by John Wayne and Clint Eastwood and a host of other laconic stoic models. But this new generation of warriors did not always understand that it was okay to weep at funerals. And they tried to live by the don't cry rule without making peace with the memory. Sometimes it worked, but sometimes it festered, swelled, and ate away at them. Before and after the war, he was a farmer. Never married, never discussed the army, yet wore the issue khaki while riding the tractor, kept his bedroom as Spartan as a barracks, ate only vegetables, and drank well water. The day before he died at 83, of the old man's friend, pneumonia, his mind flashed back to the Philippines. He shouted out, "Get down, get down," and flung his shit-stained boxers against the threatening enemy wall. Thrashed and clawed and yelled and spat so much, the nurses had to strap his hands, sedate him. 2 months before he died, he told a story. Only war story that he ever mentioned. He and a Jap, not 20 yards apart, faced each other with weapons aimed, not fired. Nip Arisaka and his M1 Garand. They stood that way for nearly 30 minutes, then parted, like lovers for the first time. Collier H. Owens, Uncle Joe. Fighter pilots as a model. Fierce, fiery warriors fought upon the clouds, in ranks and squadrons, in right form of war. Shakespeare, Julius Caesar. During the 20th century, only the fighter pilots got the chance to do it right. In the horrific, violent wars of that century, the ground troops often found themselves in day and night combat operations, unable to debrief every night. But the fighter pilots did debrief after every battle. In both formal and informal debriefings, they multiplied the joy and divided the pain, and their attitude toward killing in combat was much healthier. When a fighter pilot got a kill, his buddies toasted him, and his crew chief proudly painted a small enemy flag on his aircraft. When he killed 5 of the enemy, he was called an ace and was honored and respected. When he killed an all-time record number of the enemy, he was given the highest honor and lifted up as an example for all. This idolizing and adoration of the fighter pilot has held true throughout the 20th century. But for the poor infantryman who kills an enemy soldier, the situation has become quite different. Very successful snipers, or soldiers who receive major awards for valor, sometimes have the number of enemy killed carefully set forth in their award citations. But the individual rifleman who kills only a few enemy soldiers is often ashamed to tell how many kills he has made. Why should there be such a remarkable difference between the way a fighter pilot and an infantryman feel about their kills? Perhaps it is because sometimes the enemy pilot is able to bail out so that the fighter pilot can occasionally defeat his opponent without having to actually kill him. But the rifleman also wounds or captures many enemy soldiers, defeating them without having to kill them. Perhaps this difference exists because the pilot kills at a distance and is only shooting at a machine, which allows him to partially deny the reality of his killing. I address the difference created by distance in detail in On Killing, and will not go into the subject in detail here, other than to say that although it is an important factor, I do not believe it is the major one in this case. I think the major difference between the fighter pilot and the poor bloody infantryman is how he feels about what he has done. The fighter pilot has always formally processed what he did with approving, supportive leaders after every day's work. And then that night, he did it again over a beer with complimentary friends. Usually, the infantryman did not get the chance to do any of this, and he never made peace with the memory, unless he was a Medal of Honor recipient who was lauded and lionized. He never got a chance to multiply the joy, and all too often, he never divided the pain. Instead, he multiplied the pain and divided the joy. Instead of a magnificent tiger striding proudly in with his prey in his mouth, many infantrymen and police officers have been turned into cowed, shame-faced dogs who slink in and lick their wounds. They are often ashamed of what they did, and all too often our society acts like we are ashamed of them. The fighter pilot who paints 21 enemy flags on his aircraft is a proud hero, but the infantryman, who puts 21 notches in his rifle, is considered to be deviant and deranged. Why? Because the fighter pilot and his comrades are proud of his heroic action. They tell the world of what he did, and all his friends affirm to one and all that there was honor and glory in his deeds. Their leaders mirror and magnify these attitudes, and, perhaps most importantly, they will vigorously, righteously, and happily channel their warrior spirit into a swift punch in the nose for anyone who is foolish enough to claim otherwise. It should be dangerous to attack a warrior, but when we turn our protectors into cowed puppies, they sometimes do not even have the spirit to defend themselves from the kicks of an ungrateful public. And in the end, they may not be able to protect us and our loved ones at the moment of truth. It may trouble us to think that we should congratulate, praise, and reward a man who kills someone in honorable combat. But the alternative is to have disposable soldiers and one-shot throwaway police officers. The alternative to honoring them is to destroy them for doing exactly what we told them to do. We employ them, equip them, enable them, and empower them to kill. And then when they do, we act ashamed of them. This is a shameful and inexcusable thing to do. And the first step in correcting this is for the warrior and his comrades, like the fighter pilots, to honor themselves. I had the privilege of witnessing a powerful affirmation and honoring of a young warrior one day when I was training at a state SWAT conference. The head of the state police SWAT team, an old sergeant with many gun battles under his belt, introduced a young officer from a rural police department and told how he had recently been shot in the face and was still recovering from his wounds. He told how the young officer had been shot and survived. Best of all, the old sergeant said, he got back up and killed the bastard who shot him. There was a growling roar of affirmation from the crowd upon hearing these words, and I could see that young warrior hold his head high with shining eyes. There is honor if we honor them. There is glory if we give it to them. And the process starts within the warrior community, and then it works outward. Two case studies. How not to leave our mentally wounded behind. I just wanted to thank you again for leading the way and teaching us how not to leave our mentally wounded behind. It was an honor to finally meet you and to tell you thanks for being a major part of my recovery and helping me to save my career, marriage, and life, not in that order. Correspondence to Colonel Grossman. The first case study is a tragic tale in which the warrior failed to debrief, and the other is a life-affirming story in which a warrior did get a chance to tell his tale among his comrades. The first is about a Vietnam veteran named Tim. In the spring of 1991, a group of West Point psychology students spent their summer conducting interviews for me at the Boston VA Medical Center. I used the data that they collected in my book on killing. Tim and another Vietnam veteran had come to the U.S. Military Academy at West Point for me to interview them in front of my cadets so that I could model the process that I wanted them to use in their interviews. We sat in my living room with Tim, his wife, my wife, a dozen West Point cadets, and me, as Tim told his story. Tim said he had never told anyone this story. This is a statement that should always set off alarm bells, since it usually means that the person has not made peace with the memory, and the experience has been eating away at him for many years. Tim was in an infantry unit in Vietnam. On one occasion, they had been out rocking and rolling all day, and then that night he was assigned extra duty, which kept him from sleeping. The next day, he was out doing the same as the day before, and then that night, the company went into a defensive position on a hilltop. There were two covered and concealed avenues of approach, two wooded draws that came close to the top of the hill. Although he was exhausted, Tim was ordered to go out with three other troops at dusk to establish an observation post, an OP, as part of the security plan. They were ordered to establish their OP in one of these draws, and another group of four soldiers would set up an OP in the wooded draw on the other side of the hill. So at the last flickering of twilight, They slipped out to their positions, scratched out shallow foxholes, and hunkered down. Tim said he was so tired that he turned to one of the other individuals in his position and said, "I had duty last night, and I didn't get any sleep." He slipped off his watch, which had a luminous dial, and handed it to him. "Just give me 30 minutes and then wake me up and I'll give you a break." The soldier agreed, and Tim went to sleep. Tim says that he had no idea how long he had been asleep before he felt a hand covering his mouth and someone shaking his shoulder. "I woke up," he said. "I groped for my weapon, and by the moonlight trickling through the forest canopy, I can see this guy pointing down the hill. When I look, I see North Vietnamese soldiers, lots of them, crawling past us and moving toward the perimeter. I pulled him over to me and whispered in his ear, 'Fire their asses up and run.' The soldier obediently popped up and emptied a magazine of ammunition from his M16 on full automatic at point-blank range, and then all hell broke loose. It was a major regimental attack coming at them from multiple directions. Tim and one other man went running into the perimeter shouting, 'It's the OP! It's the OP! We're coming in! Don't shoot!' As soon as they got in, a corporal grabbed Tim and asked, where was the rest of his OP? Tim realized that just he and one other individual had made it in. Again, the corporal asked him where the other men were. Then, 'You left them out there,' the corporal screamed. 'You left them.' For the rest of the night, the battle raged, with artillery and airstrikes all around the perimeter. Tim says he spent the entire night behind an M60 machine gun, firing all around the area of the OP to keep the enemy at bay. At dawn, the North Vietnamese finally pulled out. At first light, Tim went with a patrol to check the OPs. The men assigned to the OP on the other side of the hill all had their throats cut. They had fallen asleep on guard and had paid the price. Then they went to Tim's OP and found the two remaining members of his team. One was dead, and the other was badly wounded. 'I jumped into the hole,' Tim said, 'and I saw that the wounded one was the guy I had given my watch to. He tried to give it back to me, but I said, "No, buddy, you keep it. You keep it." To this very day, I can't wear a watch." Tim's wife had been sitting beside him as he told his story, and when he finished, she said, "It's been almost 20 years, and I never knew this. I never understood why you wouldn't wear a watch." Tim looked at me with pain in his eyes and tears running down his cheeks, and he said, "Do you understand? I abandoned those men. I left them." I shook my head and said, "Tim, listen to me. I'm an airborne ranger, an infantry officer. I teach tactics at West Point. Believe me when I tell you that an OP is a sacrificial lamb staked out to bleat once as the tiger comes through. Your only job was to warn everyone else in the company. You went out there and you set up a sleep plan. And then when you saw the enemy at point-blank range, you gave the order to open fire. Do you know how easy it would have been to hunker down and wet your pants and do nothing? You saved the lives of every man in that company that day, and you got 50% of your people out of there. You provided cover fire all night long, and you came back and got another 25% of your people out of there. You should have gotten a medal for what you did that night." He looked at me for a long time and then said, "I never looked at it that way." For over 20 years, this had been a cyst in Tim's brain, a cyst filled with guilt and self-loathing, and it had swollen and festered across the years. He had never had the chance to lay it out and examine what exactly had happened that horrific night. He had never debriefed. He had never even talked about it before. It was an event that impacted the mind of a terrified, sleep-deprived 19-year-old kid and had eaten him alive year after year. Tim was truly a victim of, as Thomas Hardy puts it in The Dynasts, aggressive fancy working spells upon a mind or rot. We will come back to Tim, but let us move ahead to the first Gulf War in 1990. That was 2 decades after Vietnam, and the U.S. military had begun to understand that there was a moral, medical, and legal obligation to conduct these debriefings. The Army had combat stress teams assigned at the brigade level, and these individuals were true pioneers in conducting critical incident debriefings. Dr. Greg Belenke, the psychiatrist and U.S. Army expert on PTSD mentioned earlier, was in command of a combat stress team during the Gulf War. During one conference that I attended with Colonel Belenke, he told the story of what happened after a soldier was killed. This soldier had stepped on an unexploded bomblet, which had become essentially a landmine, in one of the little outlying camps. Colonel Belenke grabbed a helicopter and flew out to the site, where he learned that the medic, who had treated the fatally injured man, was still in deep shock 24 hours later. When the helicopter had evacuated the body, the medic had just sat there, muttering how the man's death was his fault. He said it so often and so intensely that everyone else accepted it as the truth. When Dr. Belenke gathered all the participants for a debriefing, once they began talking, it turned out that the platoon sergeant and platoon leader felt guilt over errors they had made calling in the medevac helicopter. The group learned that the kid who died had been carrying an M203 grenade on his chest, ammunition he was supposed to have turned in, but the squad leader and team leader had let him keep it. When he stepped on the bomblet, it exploded and set off the grenade on his chest. This was a source of guilt for the team leader and squad leader, since they had failed to follow procedure. Then the medic told his story. He had raced across what could have been a minefield, dropped down beside the victim, and began CPR, though there was no heartbeat or respiration. Bloody air gurgled out the man's cheek, so the medic slapped his hand over the wound and continued to apply mouth to mouth. Bloody air gurgled out the man's chest, so the medic ripped open his shirt and tried to cover the gaping wound with his arm while continuing with CPR. Then bloody air gurgled out of the man's eye sockets. For over 20 minutes, the medic applied CPR to a bloody corpse. His own body became drenched in the man's blood. Finally, the medevac bird came, and the man was placed into a body bag, and the helicopter whisked him away into the sky. On the ground, the medic cried, "It's my fault. It's all my fault. I should have done more." His friends sat stunned with tears in their eyes. They hugged him and said, "We never understood what had happened. We never understood. It's not your fault. You did all you could do." His peers were the only ones who could convince him that it was not his fault. Dr. Belenke said that when the others said these words and embraced him, that the medic blossomed like a rose. They gave him his life back. The doctor did a follow-up on him later, and he was just fine. It was too late, though, for Tim, my Vietnam veteran friend. Although he did get a chance to talk with me and debrief about what had happened, the memory had festered and eaten away at him for too many years. About 2 years later, I got a call on the 5th of July from another Vietnam veteran. He said that I needed to call Tim's family. I had a sickening feeling why, but still I asked. Yesterday, on the 4th of July, the man said, Tim put his gun in his mouth and blew his brains out. Tim was a great American, a good father, and a noble man who answered his nation's call. He was my friend. He killed the enemy and saved the lives of many Americans. But then his society told him to be ashamed of what he did. He was not alone. For years after, the citizens of his nation attacked and condemned the returning Vietnam veteran, pouring salt on his festering PTSD. The shameful degradation and condemnation of the Vietnam veteran by the American public is addressed in detail in my book on killing. All warriors are responsible for their own actions. You cannot lead a warrior life any other way. But from one perspective, Tim's chain of command, his buddies, and his fellow citizens killed him that night, just as surely as he killed himself, though it was done largely out of ignorance. Today we know that debriefings are critical. In these violent times, we hold each other's lives in our hands in the battle and after the battle, and we are morally obligated to be there for each other. Pain shared is pain divided, but Tim never got a chance to share that pain. We know that you are only as sick as your secrets, but Tim never got a chance to share his secrets, so they ate him alive. It does not have to be this way. We have a moral, medical, and legal obligation to be there for each other after the fact. Getting it right again. And the deep roots are not touched by the frost. Let us sing the old songs when all the new songs have been sung. A Finnish proverb. Throughout the 20th century, we did it wrong. When the nature of combat changed and we could no longer conduct nighttime debriefings, no longer multiply the joy and divide the pain after the day's battle so we could live with ourselves after, we inadvertently multiplied the pain and divided the joy. Now let us reach back into our past with wisdom and understanding to find the warrior heritage, the deep roots that sustained our forefathers across the centuries. J.R.R. Tolkien, writing in The Lord of the Rings, wrote powerfully and eloquently about the need to tap into the deep roots of our heritage after the long, bitter years of hard frost. Not all that is gold doth glitter, not all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither, and the deep roots are not touched by the frost. So now, as we enter into the 21st century, we are finally getting it right again. The two case studies we just examined are more than just two warriors, one destroyed by combat and one who lived. These are two models, two paths. One leads to death and destruction, the other to healing and redemption. In his book, A War of Nerves, Soldiers and Psychiatrists in the 20th Century, Ben Shepherd emphasizes the importance of social and cultural responses to combat stress. In particular, he emphasizes immediate local help given by those who understand concepts of military group bonding, underpinned by supportive leaders and affirmative comrades. He also points out the importance and value of sex, memories of sex, singing, and humor. Far from being placebos, these are actually powerful survival mechanisms that have been developed across the millennia to help diffuse traumatic situations by reasserting normality into our lives. Critical incident debriefings have come under academic scrutiny and even a degree of attack and condemnation by some psychologists and psychiatrists. Those who have been in a stressful incident can find value in coming together as a group, sorting out the memory distortions, filling in the memory gaps, confronting the irrational guilt, recognizing the achievements, learning the lessons, multiplying the joy, and dividing the pain of the traumatic event. Warriors have done this throughout history. This is very similar to what happens in funerals and wakes. To say that a debriefing is harmful is like saying that funerals and wakes are harmful. Those who are members of the critical incident stress management community sometimes feel that these attacks are really a turf battle, motivated by therapists and counselors who believe that their source of income and prestige is being threatened. There can be no doubt that the empowerment of individuals and groups to conduct debriefings has intruded on some of the turf that was once solely owned by the psychiatrist and the psychologist, and some may be threatened or offended by this. Still, there is some value in these concerns, and it is quite appropriate to constantly examine the process being used to ensure that we do the best job possible. If we are going to do these debriefings and provide this cultural social support, and we must, then we are obligated to do it right. This means that we need to constantly research and study and develop the best methodology. Recent research on the effectiveness of critical incident debriefings in military units returning from peacekeeping missions found that the debriefing can potentially do harm, just as any medical procedure can if it is done incorrectly. Research and common sense indicates that there are several things that we must consider. First, we must not force individuals to participate. Experience has shown that they will participate voluntarily if we explain why this is important. There are two key pieces of information that need to be communicated. First, stress is a key disabler and destroyer of warriors. And second, although some may not need the debriefing, it is a tool that can help them save their buddies' lives in the years to come. Second, it is important that warriors are not required to conduct their debriefings after returning home. The soldier's departure from the war zone can be delayed. There are always legitimate reasons for transportation delays, so that the debriefing can be conducted in country as soon after the battle as possible. It is extremely demoralizing for a soldier to be forced to stop and debrief when his wife and children are waiting for him right outside the gate. Next, if at all possible, outsiders should not conduct the debriefing. Someone they know, trust, and respect someone with the same background and the same warrior ethos, and someone who has been with them in the past should do it. Next, the debriefing should not stand alone. It should be part of a continuum of psychological support, which includes referrals for counseling, education, and follow-up for those who need it. Remember, no macho man. A warrior makes use of all available resources to win the battle. And it just makes sense to use state-of-the-art medical and psychiatric assistance if you think you might need it. Finally, try to avoid having a sob fest. We understand if our brothers and sisters weep, but the participants should go into the debriefing knowing that one key objective is to de-link the memory from the physiological arousal. The breathing exercise should be used to help accomplish this. Today, the military has standardized critical incident debriefings in the form of comprehensive after-action reviews, which are conducted by unit leaders in country. The law enforcement community has also learned to follow these rules by conducting their group debriefings as soon as possible, during duty hours, and by using respected and trained superiors or peers and critical incident stress management teams from within the department. In both the military and the law enforcement community, it is understood that these debriefings are vital to develop valuable operational lessons. I am happy to report that today's warriors are becoming increasingly aware that there is a moral obligation to participate, since the debriefing is also a tool that can help save their comrades' lives in the years to come. Remember Dr. Dave Klinger's interviews with over 100 SWAT team members who shot and hit a suspect in a gunfight. The police officers in his research said that it was their friends and superiors who helped them the most. This is what the debriefing can provide for police officers, soldiers, and other warriors in dangerous and stressful professions. An opportunity to put the pieces together, figure out exactly what happened, make peace with the memory, and provide a structured environment to provide support from superiors and peers when it is most needed. A time to heal. The universe is change. Our life is what our thoughts make it. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations. The Bible tells us that there is a time to kill and a time to heal. Let there be a time to heal. Let us actively seek and choose the path of healing from this point on. Whether we approve of the combat or not, no reasonable observer could wish more pain and suffering upon those warriors who answered their nation's call as peace officers in our streets and as soldiers in distant lands. We have come over a way that with tears has been watered. We have come treading our path through the blood of the slaughtered. Out from the gloomy past, till now we stand at last. James Weldon Johnson, Lift Every Voice and Sing. Throughout the 20th century, the price of war has been horrific. We sent young men forth and they waded through rivers of tears and blood, only to be destroyed long after the battle was over. If there must be war, if there must be rough men to stand watch in the night, let us do it in such a manner that we do not destroy the individuals who we have trained, equipped, enabled, and empowered to kill. Now let us come out from the gloomy past to stand at last in a time to heal. Chapter 5. Tactical Breathing and the Mechanics of the Debriefing. Separating the Memory from the Emotions. On April 28, 2001, at 20:38 hours, I was involved in my sixth officer-involved shooting with a man intent on killing his wife, daughter, and four-year-old granddaughter. His plan was to shoot them, and he had armed himself with a .357 mag, 9mm, and a 12-gauge pump shotgun. When I arrived, the suspect immediately began firing at me with the handguns while I evacuated the daughter and granddaughter. While attempting to evacuate the wife, the suspect aimed the shotgun at us. I pushed the lady on the ground and covered her with my body. The suspect fired, and four pellets struck me in the head. Two entered my brain. The blast of the shotgun flipped me over, and I got up off the ground and pulled the lady behind cover. I engaged the suspect in a running gun battle, wounding him seven times, five fatal shots. But he would not go down. As with most headshots, I was bleeding profusely and felt as though I would soon lose consciousness when I saw the suspect coming toward the lady and me. I had fired 39 of the 40 rounds that I carry. So, using the breathing technique that you teach and that I learned in the U.S. Army Infantry Marksmanship Training 15 years ago, I slowed myself down, got a good sight picture, and fired the fatal headshot. The bullet struck him in the left eye, my exact point of aim, and ended the threat. I was wounded, bleeding profusely, and firing with only one hand, as I had to hold the lady down behind cover. This was my sixth officer-involved shooting. All have been fatal for the bad guys. I have been shot in three of those six shootings, and my body has seven bullet holes in it. I have been stabbed once and have lost a partner in the line of duty, but we must fight the good fight. Correspondence to Colonel Dave Grossman from Officer Keith Nelson Borders. Now let us examine the application of the breathing exercise to control the puppy and rein in the sympathetic nervous system. In order to do this, let us first establish a foundation of understanding the body's physiological response after the smoke clears, and let us see how the critical incident debriefing and breathing exercise can fit in. In their book, Deadly Force Encounters, Dr. Alexis Artwall and Lauren Christensen have done a great job discussing post-combat responses. These are typical reactions that many survivors of a traumatic event experience in the minutes, hours, and days after. Immediately afterwards, you might experience trembling, sweating, chills, nausea, hyperventilation, dizziness, thirstiness, an urge to urinate, diarrhea, upset stomach, and jumpiness. Later that night, you might experience sleep disturbance and nightmares. Some people do not suffer from any of these symptoms. Some experience several of them, while others experience all of them. No matter how you react, it is important to understand that your reactions are normal. In the days following the event, you might be preoccupied with what happened as you relive it over and over in your mind, second-guessing yourself and thinking you did something wrong, even when you did everything right. If you are a police officer, you might doubt your ability to function on the job, and you might be unwilling to continue in your career. You might be angry, sad, irritable, hypersensitive, vulnerable, anxious, scared, self-conscious, paranoid, and afraid of being judged by others. You might feel elated that you survived, but guilty because others did not. You might feel numb, robot-like, unnaturally calm, and alienated from those who haven't been there. Your thinking might be confused. You might experience difficulty concentrating, and you might have an impaired memory. All of this is normal. Overall, I think we can agree that it is not necessarily a pleasant time, and the individual who is experiencing this can use our help. Memory retention and critical incident amnesia. All things are taken from us and become portions and parcels of the dreadful past. Alfred Lord Tennyson, The Lotus Eaters. In the military community, it is often said that the first victim of combat is truth. Another truism is that the first report from the battlefield is always wrong. Let's say that you have the task of getting information from those involved in a deadly encounter. Your first objective is to capture and preserve the event in the minds of the participants so you can dissect the information and learn what happened. The first step in maximizing memory retention is to have everyone involved make a report immediately after the occurrence. To get detailed information, you have to do all you can to keep the participants calm and collected. Remember, from the very beginning, the goal is to de-link the memory from the emotions. Initially, you want to remove them from where the stressful event took place, as there are many associations there that can act as powerful stressors. Do not offer them coffee or other caffeinated beverages, as the stimulant may hype them even more. Even after taking these precautionary measures, many of them might be so shaky that they have difficulty writing. In those cases, consider having them tape record their initial reports. Sometimes, for legal purposes, investigators are concerned about contaminating the memory process. In those situations, you should encourage everyone involved not to go out drinking and rehashing the event with their buddies, but rather go home and get a good night's sleep to help recover additional memory. Sleep helps them achieve a calmer mental state, which in turn helps them consolidate information into their long-term memories. For those who are single and have no one to go home to, it might be helpful to spend the night with a friend. The next day, you can conduct a second interview, and then you can conduct your own informal debriefings with each other. To prevent their memories from being contaminated, instruct the participants not to read the paper or watch the news. After the first night's sleep, you can conduct an interview at the location, but you need to be ready to help the participants separate their emotions from their memories. Anticipate that you might have to stop to help an especially emotional person through the tactical breathing process, because by returning to the scene, the participants are exposed to memory cues that facilitate their recall of how the event unfolded. For example, they might see a mailbox at the scene or some other object that played a critical role that they had forgotten was there. Objects that seemed to be inconsequential to people who were not involved just might provide the missing link that brings all the information together. The day after the incident, law enforcement agencies should conduct a group critical incident debriefing, and the military should conduct the after-action review. Everyone directly involved in the incident, and even those on the periphery, should attend. If it is a police incident, include the police dispatcher and the 911 operator. If it is a military incident, you should consider including those soldiers who were nearby, though not directly involved, and include those at the command post, such as radio operators. The idea of a group critical incident debriefing is to get back on the horse and derive specific memory cues from each other. You will likely hear participants say such things as, "So that's what you did," or, "Oh, I forgot about that," or, "So when you did that, that's when I did this. Now it makes sense." Like a jigsaw puzzle that has been scattered with pieces missing, it all begins to come together as everyone adds their one or two pieces. All this is not without its flaws. A process called memory reconstruction is unavoidable in a group debriefing. What happens is that some participants reconstruct or fill in their missing pieces of memory with information learned from other participants. The mind hates a vacuum, so they might fill in the gaps and remember it as if it had actually happened to them. Some degree of memory reconstruction is inevitable, but the group debriefing is still the best possible tool for giving participants accurate information to help them remember, for helping them learn from mistakes, and for helping them on the path to returning to normal after a horrific incident. Consider conducting a second debriefing 24 to 48 hours later. This allows participants to get another night or two of sleep, which often provides for further memory consolidation. The second debriefing can also be done on location. Bruce Siddle and I co-authored an article on this topic entitled Critical Incident Amnesia. It was published in the Journal of the International Association of Law Enforcement Firearms Instructors and is posted, complete with footnotes and scholarly references, on my website, www.killology.com. Consider these steps a valuable scientific method to collect information and to help the participants prevent or overcome trauma from a stressful event. Now let us continue to examine the mechanics of the debriefing and how this tool can be used to help the warrior avoid the debilitating effects of PTSD. The moral obligation to participate in a debriefing. Beat up warriors return safely, marry and have children, and make a new life, but pass their suffering to those they love, families, children, and wife. Wives and children should be chosen, nominated for Purple Hearts. Wounded by war they've never seen, disadvantaged from the start. Another daddy just started his 40th job. He can't get close, and he can't get free. What ghostly memory holds him? Society pays for war, and so does he. Fred Grossman, a Purple Heart for you. The first thing all warriors must understand is their moral obligation to participate in a critical incident debriefing. We know that unmanaged stress is a major factor that can destroy our warriors and devastate their families. It has been mentioned before that PTSD is the gift that keeps on giving. When you are impacted by stress symptoms, your spouse and your kids are also impacted. And if it is left unchecked, all of you will continue to be affected in the years to come. One key tool to prevent PTSD is the critical incident debriefing. There are always those people who say something like, "Debriefing? I don't need no stinking debriefing." And we believe them. But the debriefing is not necessarily for them. It is for their buddy, partner, spouse, and their children. What would you not do to save a buddy's life, a partner's, or the lives of their spouses and kids? Remember, the possibility of loss of life after the event can be far greater than the loss of life during the event. Think of a debriefing this way. It is a mechanism that makes it possible to save lives. Remember, pain shared is pain divided, and you are only as sick as your secrets. In a debriefing, you have the opportunity to share those secrets and to share your pain as you come together to help each other through a traumatic event. Those who say that they do not need to participate need to ask themselves if they would withhold their fire in the middle of a life-and-death gunfight just because they were not in danger. Would they withhold medical support for someone gushing blood just because they were not hurt? Of course not. Nor should they withhold their support of others in a critical incident debriefing just because they do not think they need a debriefing. After one of the major school massacres, I taught first responders about the importance of participating in a debriefing for their friends. There was a fire chief there who, after hearing my explanation, became angry with the people who had debriefed him and his crew. "Why didn't they tell us that?" he said. "A lot of our guys thought they didn't need a debriefing, so they came in with an attitude. If they had told us that we were there for our friends, they would have had a completely different attitude. We would have done anything for our friends, but they treated us like children. They packed us all in and they debriefed us without explaining what we were going to be doing and that we were doing it for our friends." Objective of a debriefing: delinking the memory from the emotions. Give sorrow words. The grief that does not speak whispers to the o'er-fraught heart and bids it break. Shakespeare, Macbeth. It is important to let participants know that any thoughts or reactions they experience during a critical incident debriefing are okay. For example, they need to know up front that if they lost their bowel and bladder control during their incident, that this is a normal response shared by many others who have gone through the same experience. You can spend a lifetime debriefing people, and few, if any, will admit that they soiled their pants. If they learn up front, though, that it is normal and okay, it is amazing how many people will reveal that it happened. The same is true for those who experience the "thank God it wasn't me" response. Having this thought race through your mind upon seeing violent death is arguably one of the deepest, darkest, most shameful of all human responses. However, when you tell people that it is a normal thought, it is as if a huge weight had been lifted and their sense of shame no longer has power to hurt them. But the most important objective of a debriefing is to sever, separate, and pull apart the memory from the emotions, delinking the memory of the event from the sympathetic nervous system arousal. You want to make peace with that memory, so every time the puppy tries to blow through that screen door and bark, "Gunfight, gunfight, where, you stop and use the tactical breathing method that will be outlined in this chapter. The idea is to patch that hole in the screen door, because if you do not, every time the puppy blows through, he makes it bigger, more ragged, and harder to patch. As the debriefing unfolds, and you work your way through the memory of the event, know that anything and everything is permitted. The only thing not permitted is anxiety. If you begin to perspire, your voice begins to quiver, your eyes begin to well up with tears, your face becomes white and blotchy, and your hands begin to shake, you need to stop and do tactical breathing. After just a few cycles of this incredible technique, you experience a wave of calm and relaxation that begins to help you delink the physiological arousal from the memory of the event. In short, you begin to make peace with the memory. Let's look at this powerful and versatile tool that helps you before, during, and after a critical incident. Tactical Briefing, A Leash on the Puppy. On September 6, 2001, while working on a robbery task force, I used tactical breathing seconds prior to shooting and killing a masked armed robber in a grocery store. The detectives had received information that this guy was going to rob a grocery store in town, so my partner and I were assigned to be in the store as the takedown team. He was going to use the M26 taser to subdue the subject. In the previous six robberies, the suspects had been armed with a revolver, a semi-auto handgun, and a sawed-off shotgun. My job was to cover my partner. The detectives saw the suspects leave in a vehicle, and they began a moving surveillance on them. We could hear what was going on over the police radio. The suspects drove by the store several times and stopped a couple of times to see if anyone was following them. Eventually, one of them was dropped off nearby. We had surveillance set up in the parking lot, and he could see the suspect at the end of the building. Surveillance was giving us play-by-play of what the suspect was doing. He would crouch down behind a dumpster to conceal himself when cars drove by the store. We had plenty of time to think about what was going to happen. I realized my heart rate was elevating. You know when you smash your finger with a hammer or slam your finger in a car door and the finger starts throbbing? That's how my heart felt. I told myself that it was time to start breathing. I kept breathing the way you instructed until I felt my heart stop pounding. I'm not sure how long it took, but I knew when I was ready, so I thought. It took half a second to fire seven rounds from the MP5 submachine gun on full auto. Six rounds struck the moving target. The next thing I remember was standing over the suspect thinking, "Bring it on," and "Holy shit," at the same time. Correspondence to Colonel Dave Grossman from Officer Rick Leno. Tactical breathing is an easy-to-do technique that can be used in a stressful situation to slow your thumping heartbeat, reduce the tremble in your hands, deepen your voice so you do not sound like Mickey Mouse, and to bathe yourself with a powerful sense of calm and control. In other words, it is a tool to control the sympathetic nervous system. One police officer who used tactical breathing in a confrontation with an armed robber summed it up with these succinct and powerful words. Using the breathing technique, I slowed myself down, got a good sight picture, and fired the fatal headshot. After a critical incident, tactical breathing is a highly effective tool to help you de-link your physiological arousal from your memory of the event. Here is what is happening inside your mind and body, and why this simple breathing method quickly restores your calm and control. For our purposes, let us divide your body into two parts, the somatic nervous system and the autonomic nervous system. The somatic nervous system is involved in those actions you have under conscious control, such as moving your arms and kicking a stone out of your path. The autonomic nervous system is involved with those things that you do not have under conscious control, such as your heartbeat and perspiration. Indulge me for a moment and try a little physical demonstration that will help you completely grasp the differences in these two nervous systems. First, let's test your somatic nervous system. Raise your right arm. Excellent. You have demonstrated your mastery of the somatic nervous system. Okay, you can lower it now. Stay with me. It'll get harder. Now, let's test your autonomic nervous system. When I say go, I want you to raise your heart rate to 200 beats per minute. Start perspiring and see if you can manifest a little stress diarrhea. Ready? Go. What happened? You failed because you cannot consciously control your heart rate, make yourself perspire, or have stress diarrhea, even if you wanted to. It is called the autonomic nervous system because these actions are automatic. They are not under conscious control. As you heard the last two sentences, your inhalation and exhalation were also autonomic actions. If you had to consciously control your breathing, you would die when you fell asleep. That said, please take a deep breath and then let it out. With that conscious action, you just pulled your breathing from autonomic to somatic control. Breathing and blinking are the only two actions of your autonomic nervous system that you can bring under conscious control anytime you choose. As such, your breathing is the bridge between your somatic and autonomic nervous system. Think of your autonomic nervous system as a big, shuddering, shaking machine that has only one control lever sticking out from its side. Your breathing is that control lever, the one thing you can reach out and grab. When you control your breathing, you control the whole autonomic nervous system. As discussed earlier, the autonomic nervous system has two branches, the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. Through proper breathing, you can control your sympathetic nervous system response, the fancy term for fear and anger. As mentioned earlier, uncontrolled fear and anger are the same thing. They are just two different manifestations of the puppy getting out of control. Tactical breathing is a leash on the puppy. The more you practice the breathing technique, the quicker the effects kick in, as a result of powerful classical and operant conditioning mechanisms. Although we continuously find new uses for tactical breathing, it is really nothing new. The yoga, Zen, and martial arts communities have used breathing control for centuries. The rifle marksmanship community has used it for over 100 years. And the Lamaze community has used it for over 50 years. I tell my warrior audiences to think of tactical breathing as combat Lamaze. Yoga, Zen, and the martial arts may have some mystical connotations, but when you strip away the mysticism, all that is left is a simple process that allows you to gain conscious control over your unconscious nervous system and then puts it to work for you. It is really just common sense. Have you heard these expressions? I was scared out of my wits. I was so scared that I couldn't see straight, or I got the crap scared out of me. These are all common expressions to communicate some of the things we have been talking about in this audiobook. In the same way, when we were children and overly excited about something, many of us were told by our mother, just take a deep breath. Well, Mama knew what she was talking about. Except for us, it would be three deep belly breaths. The technical term for the procedure is autogenic breathing, but in the warrior community, it is typically called tactical breathing or combat breathing, though it is derived from many places. Caliber Press and Gary Klugerwitz should be credited with pioneering it and spreading it throughout the warrior community. Due to poor planning on my part, I once found myself in front of an abortion clinic where 100 sign-waving protesters wanted a piece of me. Half were pro-choice and half were pro-life. More were arriving every minute. There was shouting and pushing, and when a couple of big guys tried to push me aside, I pushed back, inadvertently knocking one man, a national leader, down a set of steps. That ignited his people, and they began screaming hysterically, some threatening to get me. My eyes were watering profusely. I was trembling, and my chest was heaving as if I had run a mile. I held my position, and, imperceptible to the crowd, I drew a long, deep, quiet breath. Held it for a four-count moment, and then slowly and quietly released it for a four-count. I paused empty for a four-count and then repeated the procedure. After the third cycle, my trembling had stopped, my breathing had quieted, and my eyes cleared. I remained calm until my backup arrived, a police officer. I teach tactical breathing to Green Berets, federal agents, and even surgeons in hospitals, so they do not lose their fine motor control in the middle of an operation. My definition of a bad day is when my surgeon begins to lose fine motor control. I also teach it to basketball players to improve their free throw rate, and to college kids suffering from test anxiety. I know of one martial arts instructor and two police officers who used it in the middle of their heart attacks. Four deep belly breaths, and they were able to pull their heart rate down. Many police officers have contacted me over the years to relate how they have used tactical breathing to make desperate life and death shots, or how they have taught it to their kids to use when they get hurt. But my favorite story comes from one of my college students. I taught this young man the breathing exercise when he was in my intro psychology course. In fact, I taught it to all of my students in order to help them with test anxiety. A couple of years later, this student came up to me in a supermarket in Jonesboro, Arkansas, and said, "Hey, Colonel Grossman, you remember that breathing exercise you taught us? That stuff really works." I asked him what happened. "I got in a traffic accident," he said, and my car flipped over, and I was trapped with a broken leg. I began to panic, and then out of the blue, I remembered what she taught us. The mind is like that. If you are trained, what you need will be there for you, and sometimes it seems to come out of the blue. I began to panic, the young man said, and then it was just like you were there in class making me do it during a test. I began breathing in through my nose, holding it, as you had taught, exhaling, and then holding empty. You know what? That worked. It calmed me down. I asked the young man what happened next. What could I do? I'm trapped in my car. I reached over, turned the radio on my favorite station, and waited for somebody to come get me. They eventually got there with the jaws of life, pried the car apart, and pulled me out. They told me that if I had panicked, I would have probably killed myself. If he had panicked, he would have probably killed himself. What did Yoda teach us about fear? Fear leads to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. And hate leads to much suffering. The degree to which you control fear and anger is the degree to which you control your hate and suffering. Your goal is to prevent fear, prevent anger, prevent hate, and prevent suffering. The degree to which you control your fear is the degree to which you have mastered yourself as a warrior. The mechanics of tactical breathing. The devil is in the details. Old German military maxim. There is still a need for extensive research to see how long each phase should be held, but for many years now, the four-count method has worked wonders for warriors around the globe. Once you start using it, you can tailor it to your body's needs. For example, you might find that you need to hold each count for 5 seconds, that you need 5 cycles of the procedure to achieve the desired effect. This is fine. It is just like adjusting a tuning knob. Grab hold of the knob and keep turning it until you get dialed in to the level that works for you. For now, let us use the 4-count method. Begin by breathing in through your nose to a slow count of 4, which expands the belly like a balloon. Hold for a count of 4, and then slowly exhale through your lips for a count of 4, as your belly collapses like a balloon with its air released. Hold empty for a count of 4, and then repeat the process. That is it. Short, but effective. Now, follow along as I guide you through the procedure. In through the nose, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Out through the lips, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. In through the nose, deep, deep, deep. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Out through the lips, deep, deep, deep. Hold, 2, 3, 4. In through the nose, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Out through the lips, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Maybe you are feeling a little mellow now, or maybe you didn't notice a difference since you were already relaxed. But in a life and death situation, we know this simple exercise can be a true revolution in human development. For the first time in human history, we are teaching large portions of our population to consciously control the unconscious part of their body. Tactical breathing in warrior operations. Our tactical unit was involved in the fatal shooting of a suspect recently during a protracted barricade situation. The suspect was a former prison gang member wanted for homicide and had become trapped during a home invasion while fleeing the police. One of our shooters, after the incident, made some comments that I thought you might find interesting. The officer was in a position approximately 40 feet from the suspect when he ultimately fired and struck the suspect with his M4 carbine. The area was dark and the officer was wearing a protective mask because of chemical agents, tear gas, previously fired into the structure. Over time, the suspect made numerous statements to negotiators that he was going to come out shooting, that the officers had better get ready because I'm going to blow.